Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 1:32 p.m. We are in Belt's Room 105, the Thomas Stewart Building, in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Wednesday, February 7th. Members present at the committee today are Senator Merrick, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business today. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Lisa Denny, and our LIO moderator, Joseph Giesbrecht. Today, we have two items on our agenda. First up is Senate Bill 191, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, power to make or purchase mortgage loans, and Senate Bill 209, electronic monitoring of fishing vessels. First up is Senate Bill 191. To present the bill, we have Ike Gialopsos, Executive Director, Deputy Executive Director with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Could you please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Ike Gialopsos, and I serve as the Deputy Executive Director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Mr. Chairman, with me in the room today with the committee's indulgence is the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, Mr. Fadil Lamani, who also sits as a designee to the corporation's Board of Directors. And with your permission, Mr. Chairman, we would request that Mr. Lamani be afforded a brief moment or two to introduce the elements of the bill.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lamani, please state your name and affiliation for the record. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fadil Lamani. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. As Ike mentioned, I also sit as the Department of Revenue designee on the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation Board. I appreciate the opportunity of being here and sharing Department of Revenue's view as it pertains to SB 191. Mr. Chair, the proposed legislation would enable AHFC to modify the residential lending programs that provide additional loan opportunities to Alaskan families. Currently, with the high interest rate environments and the down payment requirements, it makes it difficult for home buyers, particularly first-time home buyers, to secure a loan for their home purchase. This legislation, Mr. Chair, increases the loan-to-value from 95% to 97%, which significantly reduces the down payment requirements to homebuyers that enables AHFC to compete with other government-sponsored loan programs that are being offered currently by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This, Mr. Chair, also is a GOV mission-critical legislative priority as it addresses the livability aspect and provides Alaskans with access to housing and keeping families in Alaska and attracting more people to live in Alaska. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn this back to the Deputy Executive Director, Akis Gialopsos. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Akis Gialopsos. And for the committee's edification, online to answer questions are Ms. Michelle Graves, who serves as the director for the mortgage department at the corporation, as well as our chief executive officer and executive director, Mr. Brian Butcher. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I will briefly discuss why the corporation's mission is entwined in this piece of legislation, explain the bill to the best of my abilities, along with a very brief sectional analysis, and answer what questions are within my capacity to do so from yourself and your committee members.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To begin with, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which was founded in 1971, has a mission to provide Alaskans with access to safe, quality, and affordable housing. And it does so through three prongs. It works to develop and increase the housing stock primarily through the low-income housing tax credit and the rural professional programs. It augments and improves the housing stock through our weatherization and our rebate programs. That has resulted in one in five residences in the state of Alaska being touched in some degree by funding through the corporation to improve energy uses by decreasing that consumption on average by one-third over the course of the past 20 years. The third prong of that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is by being able to provide access to the housing stock through various financial instruments, and that is the basis upon which we respectfully come before your committee today. Mr. Chairman, Alaska Statute 1856-096 Alpha 4 specifically limits the corporation, as the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue mentioned, to the ability to purchase single-family residences on a first conventional loan to a loan-to-value ratio of no more than 95%. Now, with respect, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure yourself and committee members understand that, but for the edification of the public, a loan-to-value ratio is a device that lenders use to determine what proportion of a loan would need to cover an appraised asset for purchase. So therefore, a loan-to-value ratio of 95 on a hypothetical structure of $100,000 would require $5,000 on the part of the borrower to come with in the form of a down payment. This does not, of course, include closing costs, which can be up to 3% of the appraised value. And this device, Mr. Chairman, is utilized as one among several tools that lenders would use to determine the risk factor that a borrower may have on default or any type of delinquency issues and the creditworthiness of that transaction. But it's one of several. And that's why traditionally loans that have a ratio above 80, so less than 20% traditionally down, require some degree of private mortgage insurance, as the corporation does as well currently. What's changed, Mr. Chairman, that has necessitated this proposal before the legislature and your committee are two key factors. One is that the main counterparts to the corporation, which are the government-sponsored entities from the federal side, that is colloquially called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, 10 years ago began offering products that allowed a loan-to-value ratio of 97%, essentially lowering the down payment requirement on the part of a borrower from 5% to 3%. The second, Mr. Chairman, and it's of no surprise to anyone on this committee, I am assured, has been the significant run-up in the average appraised values of homes on the market throughout the state of Alaska, particularly in the past 5 years. As that appraised value has gone up, so too are the costs to otherwise creditworthy borrowers. If I may, Mr. Chairman, direct the committee's attention to a handout that your aide provided in the committee packet that's entitled Impact of Proposed Loan-to-Value LTV Legislation SB 191. There are three different charts, Mr. Chairman, that show what the average sale price for a single-family home between 2019 and 2023 were in the Kenai, Fairbanks, and Anchorage area. And though the numerics may vary slightly, the trend is inescapably the same. In Anchorage, you have seen the run-up from $250,000 for an average house to climb to nearly $400,000. And consequently, under our rules, the required down payment on the part of a potential borrower has increased from $12,500 5 years ago to nearly $20,000 today. We do not believe at the corporation that the creditworthiness of borrowers have deteriorated, but merely their purchasing power has as well. And so the corporation respectfully comes forward to ask for this provision to remove the 95% loan-to-value restriction, thereby allowing it, as the Deputy Commissioner said, to have the ability for its board in the mortgage department to set products that would be competitive and perhaps more so than that of its federal counterparts. Having a higher loan-to-value ratio does mean that an individual borrower, if they qualify, would have less to put down. And because we already require private mortgage insurance and have to go through our due diligence process, and the corporation and the state as a whole has historically been leading the nation in terms of a lack of defaults and a lack of foreclosures, we believe any incremental risk is more than offset by these provisions. And the trade-off is that more Alaskans are going to have access to the attractiveness of home ownership without that debilitating additional cost that would otherwise disincentivize them from being able to put down roots in their community. The second element that the bill does, Mr. Chairman, in that same paragraph, is it essentially engages in cleanup language. When this portion of language was drafted in 1983 originally, Mr. Chairman, and we know that date thanks to the good work of the folks at the Legislative Affairs Agency's library, the specific staffer Magdalena and Olga, who were kind enough to find that information for us, we found that lines 19 through 22 on page 2 of the proposed legislation were duplicative and served no instrumental purpose in legislation. And since the only other opportunity to clean this up would be through a reviser bill, we respectfully suggest that if the committee deem this policy worthy of proceeding, that this cleanup language go forward as well. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my initial prepared remarks. I'm happy to proceed with a brief sectional or to answer questions on behalf of the corporation to the committee.
Very good. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. So looking at these charts, my first question is, this would apply to condos and duplexes, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gray Jackson, this applies to single-family residences.
Only?
And we can, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gray Jackson, we can ask clarity from our Director of Mortgage, Ms. Michelle Graves, on the line as well.
Okay, if I can follow up, Mr. Chairman?
You may.
Because I would like to see it apply to condos, which are less expensive, and also duplexes. And if I may ask another question.
Indeed.
So the 6.5% interest rate on the slide here, is that the current interest rate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gray Jackson, as of this morning, our conventional loan is at 6.5%. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome. Senator Gray Jackson. I'm sorry, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you had someone online to answer Senator Gray Jackson's question. I don't know if they want to respond first for my question.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, this is Brian Butcher. Can you hear me?
Good afternoon, Brian. We can hear you just fine.
Okay. For the record, I'm Brian Butcher, CEO, Executive Director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. In the answer to Senator Gray Jackson's question, yes, this would apply to condos. It would also apply to duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes. Anything fourplex or under, it would apply to if the purchaser was living in one of the units. It would not apply to anything larger, you know, a multifamily, an 8-plex, an 18-plex.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Director, in the letter of support from the Alaska Bankers Association states that relaxing LTV requirements can stimulate demand for housing. It occurs to me that what we have in Alaska right now, our challenges are primarily not about demand for housing. In fact, we have a lot of demand for housing. The problem is supply of housing. And so I guess my two questions for you are, one, can these loans be used for housing construction? And two, is there any chance that, because you're such a large entity that touches so many areas, is there a chance that this bill could increase, even marginally increase, costs, increase prices of housing in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dunbar, I'll respectfully defer to our Chief Executive Officer as to the first part of the question and to the directors that are online.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, this is focused specifically on being able to kind of level the playing field between HFC and our competitors, Fannie and Freddie Mac, by allowing there to be more Alaskans able to access our program. More demand will result in home builders needing to build more housing because the number of Alaskans that qualify to purchase a home will go up. But in terms of specifically focusing on more housing construction, we have a number of programs that will be focusing on that, but the intent of this specific legislation isn't necessarily for that.
That's a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
So my understanding is that, as you stated, that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac already offer these kind of products. So is it fair to say that AHFC offering these kind of products as well will have only a, you know, marginal – it'd be more a question of them choosing you over one of your competitors rather than a new product that's likely to drive up housing prices. Not housing construction, but actual the price of existing housing stock because more people could access these kind of loans.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dunbar, I will defer to the Chief Executive momentarily, but I would respectfully say that I believe that that would not be entirely the case for two reasons. One is, in comparison to the government-sponsored entities of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which up until recently had lower interest rates on account of the actions of the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has comparatively a more competitive interest rate in the last couple of years as a result of this. So, in fact, we would see prices and affordability be more reflective on the positive side of the borrower. You are completely correct that supply and demand dynamics are at play here, and there is a constricted amount of supply that is at play. But what we are seeing in the short to midterm is that there is a continued outward migration of individuals throughout the state. And one of the best ways to incentivize them to stay here while ongoing construction efforts occur throughout our major metropolitan and rural hub areas is to do that third prong that we mentioned, which is to provide access to the existing housing stock. It is less reflective potentially of a run-up in the valuation that would be exacerbated by this, and more of finding individuals who currently are on the sidelines that are competing against cash borrowers. And so we would actually see, and I think that the letter that the Bankers Association speaks to, is that that stagnated capital on the part of residences would be liberated. And Mr. Chairman, I appreciated the clarification for the record from our chief executive to Senator Gray Jackson's question. I apologize if there was any error. We define single-family residences as 1 through 4 units as long as they reside within that unit. So I think that's an important clarification, and I apologize for any misconstruing that occurred on my end.
Senator Bishop.
I just got a clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ike, you said something about, you said cash borrowers. Did you mean to say cash buyers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bishop, thank you for that opportunity to clarify. Thank you. Cash buyers. And to that point, Mr. Chairman, what we are seeing nationally in Alaska is a historic proportion of entrants in the housing market that are making outright cash purchases. Roughly anywhere between 20 to 38% of Americans own a home outright at this juncture and are realizing that equity, and they form part of the counterparties to any aspiring first-time or any homeowner that doesn't have similar levels of equity. Being able to have the loan-to-value ratios be increased provides some meaningful degree of an otherwise creditworthy borrower who qualifies for the loan on the merits of their economics to not have to have such a structured disadvantage against an individual who can come in and purchase a property outright. It admittedly is not meant to be a panacea, and no proposed solution would be, but these are part of the accumulation of proposals that could add up to making those marginal improving differences for ordinary Alaskans.
Further questions from members of the committee? Seeing no further questions, Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Lamani, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. back on the record, Belt's room 105 of the Thomas Stewart building. It's 1:52 p.m. Up next in front of Senate Labor and Commerce is Senate Bill 209, Electronic Monitoring of Fishing Vessels. To present the bill, we have the Department of Fish and Game Commissioner, Doug Vincent Lang, and Legislative Liaison, Joe Beckel. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliations for the record and begin your presentation.
Okay. For the record, my name is Doug Vincent Lang. I'm the Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
For the record, Joe Fokel, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Fish and Game.
So this bill basically authorizes the Board of Fisheries to require electronic monitoring in a fishery and grants the Commissioner of Fish and Game the authority to implement the program as authorized by the Board. Last year, when the Board of Fisheries was talking about the REM fishery on the Alaska Peninsula, there was a lot of discussion about the chucking of chums that were going off the side of vessels, potentially same vessels and gillnet vessels. And there was a large discussion that occurred as to how they could monitor that to ensure that that wasn't occurring if we put a chum cap in place. The Board asked me whether we had the authority to implement electronic monitoring. And when we had a discussion with the Department of Law, we found out that we had the ability to put an observer on board a vessel, but we did not have the ability to put electronic monitoring on a vessel because it wasn't authorized by statute. So this would permissively allow the Board of Fisheries to create an observer program, I mean a electronic monitoring program as an alternative to an observer program, which in many cases would be cheaper. This would include equipment such as video cameras and gear sensors that capture information in fishing locations and catch. And again, electronic monitoring systems, also known as EM, offer the potential to reduce cost while improving accuracy and providing data in near real time when compared to human observers. For those applicable fisheries, more accurate and timely data will benefit our fishery stock assessments by improving the information we use to manage them sustainably. Electronic monitoring can also be used as an enforcement tool in fisheries where mandatory retention regulations are in place, often referred to as bycatch. This is a permissive statutory change. Any proposal to require electronic monitoring in one of Alaska's fisheries would have to go through a very involved Board of Fisheries process, including public notice, review by the department and local advisory committees, and public comment. The Board is also required to factor into its deliberative process the cost to a fisherman when they're implementing a new regulation. Sustainable management of Alaska's fisheries is required by Alaska Constitution, and an effective decision-making about Alaska's shared aquatic resources require accurate, timely, and cost-effective data collection. The Department supports this bill because having an option for an electronic monitoring program in statute adds another important tool in the toolbox for us for using managing Alaska's fisheries. And I'm going to add a little bit to that statement. The only option the Board of Fisheries currently has is putting an observer on board a boat. Many of the boats that potentially have issues regarding illegal discards or mandatory retention that would want to be looked at are very small boats. It's almost nearly impossible for an observer to be placed on the decks of those boats. A seine boat, for instance, has got four or five people operating the same gear already. And also you'd have to house that person on board the deck, on board the vessel while they're out for multiple days, so that there's often very limited bunk space on these vessels. Electronic monitoring would alleviate some of those concerns. So why is this needed? For decades, accounting for what fishermen keep and what they discard has been accomplished by combining information from logbooks, interviews, fish tickets, and observers. While on board, observers are a traditional way of to collect independent information on the vessel's activities and catch. Placing observers on vessels can be more intrusive and create challenges due to additional cost and space required on board for the observer to live. Electronic monitoring offers a more efficient and cost-effective alternative for the Board to consider. In recent years, electronic monitoring has been increasingly adopted to collect fishery catch data in federal fisheries. One of the most interesting things I find is that if there's a federal fishery adjacent to a state fishery, when there's electronic monitoring is required in the federal fishery, it cannot be required in the adjacent state fishery when it moves into state water fisheries. Today, both observers and electronic monitoring play key roles in fisheries management. With electronic monitoring is used in federal fisheries primarily to document the presence or absence of prohibited species, such as crab, halibut, or salmon. Current technology is not able to differentiate species or record size or sex of bycatch, but new technologies are being developed, including artificial intelligence, for processing imagery to identify species in fishing gear, estimate the weight and length, or simply determine if a vessel is in transit or fishing to determine if catch is on board. Current technology will still expand the ability to collect and share data, especially for monitoring catch. Establishing the board and department's ability to require and implement an electronic monitoring program now would allow the use of current technology and position the state to use new technologies once they are widely available. So what is the potential impact fiscal to vessel operators in the department? Installing and using new electronic monitoring system that cover all fishing activities has been demonstrated to be cheaper than placing observers on vessels. Savings estimates vary based on the fishery size and type. The largest costs of most programs are the manual video review of data, data transmission, and storage. There's no direct cost associated with this bill. Again, this is a permissive change. The bill does not require the board to require electronic monitoring in a specific fishery. That'll be determined at the board level with input from local communities and the general public. Just like the onboard observer program, the board would need to meet and establish by regulation the fisheries that they may wish to require EM on, and the department would be responsible for managing the program. The department already does this for the shellfish observer program. State costs associated with the shellfish observer program are primarily funded through the test fish revenue, federal funds, and direct payments by vessels to carry the required observers. EM could potentially be funded similarly, along with the possibility of being industry funded in part for equipment such as operators currently bear the costs associated with an onboard observer. While there are no direct costs associated with this legislation, future funding will likely be necessary to stand up a new IM program, as it may require hiring and training new staff depending upon the fishery that the board may choose to adopt. The number of new staff is contingent upon the number and type of fisheries that are required by the board to use EM. So the legislature will have an opportunity to weigh in whether, if the board creates a fishery, whether you actually want to fund it inside the department to actually make it occur. There is not something that will happen overnight. Once authorized by the board, it could take nearly 2 years before the department could implement a new electronic monitoring program. Initial implementation would require considerable regulation development to establish standards for equipment, deployment and inspection, and privacy and data handling. Finally, it is important to note that the board does not have fiscal, administrative, or budgeting authority, meaning the board cannot compel the department to institute a program unless there is an agreement, a data gap exists. Assuming there is agreement, the department would request additional funding through the budget process if needed to implement the program, thereby providing legislative review of the funding request. So with that, I'll invite Joe to go through the sectional and then answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. For the record, Joe Felkel. So Section 1 of the bill provides statutory authority for the Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game to implement an electronic monitoring program as authorized by the board. Section 2 provides statutory authority for the Board of Fisheries to adopt regulations requiring electronic monitoring in a fishery. Section 3 defines electronic monitoring for the purposes of fish and game statutes. Section 4 is a transition section that allows the Board of Fisheries and the department to adopt regulations necessary to implement the bill. Section 5 is an immediate effective date for Section 4. And then Section 6 is an effective date of January 1, 2025 for all other provisions. And that is the sectional.
Mr. Chair, if I could add one thing. I think there's some confusion when we say the word require. It allows the board to require monitoring, but it doesn't require the board to say every fishery is required to do this. It just gives them the ability to require it in a specific fishery. So it doesn't require them to require electronic monitoring across the board for all commercial fishing. So.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for that presentation. So I'm sure you've seen the responses that we've received from fishermen and others, primarily concerned with cost. And so it seems like in your presentation you said there's federal funds available, but then also perhaps requiring the boats themselves to pay for a portion, if not all of this. I guess I'm trying to think about the Area M fishery and the kind of boats that are in that fishery versus where we have observers now. Are the boats where observers are now, are they significantly larger, sort of more profitable boats? Would this be sort of smaller boats than we're typically using observers on?
Through the chair, I think it's a combination of both of them. I think there are instances on federal fisheries that have fairly large vessels that have electronic monitoring on them, and it's a cheaper option. And sometimes the observer is on board the boat, but may not be, you know, maybe off hours or a variety of other things. So the electronic monitoring kicks in during those times. But clearly on a small boat, electronic monitoring would not inconvenience the boat operator by having to bunk that person and have them on the deck space while they're fishing. So like a seine boat, you know, there's limited bunk space and there's limited deck space when you're running the seine gear. That would be an opportunity not to inconvenience that boat owner with those kinds of presences on the deck.
Cast a fault, Mr. Chair.
Indeed.
Have there been any discussions in the department or with the Board of Fish on, I mean, again, these are relatively small boats, and I agree with you. Having worked on seiners, having another person there would be incredibly inconvenient. But I don't think we do that very often now. So it's not really we're reducing costs from observer to electronic. We're sort of going from nothing to electronic monitoring, which would be potentially a significant increase in costs for these boats. So is there any other way to defray those costs? I mean, is there any talk about state funding if we want to do this? I mean, I'm just curious, you know, what if the fishermen come back and say, look, this is a lot of money for a relatively small family operation, understanding that we all care very much about the chum chucking issue and what the impacts on the Yukon-Kuskokwim.
Yeah, through the chair, you know, a lot of these programs are eligible for federal funding. A lot of these programs could be eligible for state funding. I think the question comes down to right now, the only tool that the board has when they're concerned about a fishery and the potential for some kind of violation occurring in that fishery is to put an observer on board the boat. They don't have any other option. So I think adding this tool to the toolbox gives the board another option. Now, whether they do it or not, I think is going to be dependent upon the public testimony they get, the cost associated with it, a whole wide variety of factors. Right now, observers are not on every fishing boat in the state of Alaska. And part of that reason is cost associated with it. And the balance, the board balancing the trade-off of putting an observer on board that boat versus the benefit it has. And the same would occur with electronic monitoring.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm learning a lot, and I really appreciate it. So how do you determine what boats have an observer on board?
It's usually a boat, through the chair, it's usually a boat for which there's a prohibited species catch. Like if it's a scallop boat, you may not want to catch halibut, and there's a prohibited limited number of halibut you can catch. So rather than the potential of those halibut being thrown over the side, there's usually an observer on board that boat to find out just how many, what's coming up in the trawl net and what's being discarded over the side so that you can get an accurate count of the prohibited species.
Thank you.
So, for instance, an ARIM, and maybe another example, if there's mandatory retention of all salmon caught in seine gear, you put an observer on board the boat to find out whether any salmon are being discarded at sea. That would potentially be a species for which there's a cap, for instance, in this case, chum salmon.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I realize this are probably details that will be worked out at the Board of Fish if this goes forward, but if folks are out fishing and the electronic monitor breaks, what's the impact? Do they have to stop fishing and go back to port, or can they continue? You know, obviously it's not something they are responsible for maintaining. It's something that the observer program is responsible for maintaining, but we all expect these things to break periodically. So what's the impact on fishing boats when that happens?
Yeah, through the chair, usually there's electronic monitoring that involves just one single camera. It usually involves one or two cameras on board the deck. So there's a response. You know, if everything breaks down, I think there's an obligation to stop fishing in the federal fishery. But usually there's backup equipment on board that vessel that covers the deck space and watching it. So usually it doesn't require them to come back to port.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Seeing none.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much.
We will, at this time, open public testimony on Senate Bill 209. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify to Senate Bill 209? Please come forward, state your name and affiliation for the record.
Uh, My name is Dylan Hayes. I'm a deckhand on the FB Osprey, a seiner, and a Tanner crab and Dungeness crab. We usually sell our salmon to Ocean Beauty International and our crab to Alaska Glacier Seafoods. But I am an independent contractor, so. And I, being a deckhand and not a captain, am not the one writing the checks, so the funding is not my wheelhouse. However, as a deckhand, when you say there are cameras and monitoring things to install, I would be the one who would be putting them in the harbor cart and taking them down to Float A in Aurora Harbor. I would be the one responsible for installing and maintaining those systems. And I have concerns with not just the bill, but when I parsed through the National Marine Fisheries Service Procedure 04-115-02, it says in introduction, paragraph 2, currently all appropriated funds designated for implementing systems to monitor fishing vessel activity and catch at sea are fully dedicated. So my concern is that I would take time out of my day to install and maintain these systems, and there wouldn't be anyone on the other end to monitor the systems that I installed. I think the man hours for monitoring these systems just are beyond the capabilities of NOAA at this time, and I would like to see the review for the National Marine Fisheries Service's procedures on May 1st to see if there will be someone on the other end of those systems that I would be maintaining. That is really all I have to say, but I would be happy to answer any questions from the board if you have anything to ask of me.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Chair.
Questions?
It is. Sorry, questions?
Thank you. Right. I don't see any questions. Up next in the room, we have Tracy Welsh.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Bjorkman. My name is Tracy Welch, and I'm here representing United Fishermen of Alaska. United Fishermen of Alaska is a statewide commercial fishing trade association. We right now represent 37 different fishing groups that span the statewide fisheries as well as federal fisheries operating off of Alaska's coast. We also have approximately 500 individual members as well as a host of business members. We are opposing Senate Bill 209 as currently written. We have submitted preliminary comments online, as it's been a quick turnaround since the bill's introduction. So please anticipate further comments and questions from United Fishermen of Alaska as we have a chance to develop those. The state currently does have the authority to stand up an observer program, but in doing so, the board has to consider a host of criteria, things such as feasibility, necessity, and impact to a fishery. And while this would be adding electronic monitoring, it doesn't appear from the way the bill is written right now that electronic monitoring would be factored, would have to face those same factors. A big concern for us would be the zero fiscal note, as was noted in conversation by the previous speaker. This is gonna cost somebody something. And as much as it pains me to sit up here and say this, a lot of our small boat fisheries and fishermen are seriously hurting right now with the state of the seafood industry. I believe Aleutians Eastboro at the Area M meeting two years ago, submitted a record copy saying that they did a feasibility study, and it's around $17,000 to purchase one of these units. I confirmed that with Homeport Electronics in Petersburg earlier this week, so that's in line with current market conditions. It's over $5,000 a year to operate one of these, including hookups, fixing any issues that come up throughout the year, and that doesn't even include the cost to review footage and the additional jobs that's going to be required to actually review all of this and monitor the programs. Cost to buy, operate, and fix, those are all concerns, but also having to stand down, as the commissioner noted, if equipment fails On some of the larger vessels, they may have more than one, you know, you have an observer there. However, if equipment fails, you will be forced to stand down. I talked to one of my board members yesterday who is currently facing equipment issues for a cod fishery, and he is currently waiting for someone to come to his boat to fix it, and he cannot leave until that happens. So if this is really about enforcement, can we possibly put more money towards enforcement rather than electronic monitoring? Is that an option? So United Fishermen of Alaska is not against electronic monitoring. In fact, a lot of our groups have been on the forefront of helping to develop these programs. They've been participants, work industry, working in hand with the people who are developing the programs to get the best information out of them. And so we're not against electronic monitoring. We're not against accountability, but we are have concerns that we would like to see answered. Thank you. Happy to take any questions.
Tracy, thank you for your testimony. Questions from members of the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Next, we're going to go off net to Karen Severson. Ms. Severson, please state your name and affiliation for the record. Ms. Severson, can you hear us? We'll come back. We'll go now to Charlotte Levy from the Aleutians Eastboro. Ms. Levy, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Okay. Thank you for the record. My name is Charlotte Levy, and I am the fishery analyst for the Aleutians Eastboro. I have pretty limited time to discuss a fairly complex issue, so my submitted written comments should provide some more context for you. So I work in both the state and federal fisheries arenas, and I have spent the last 6 years working with local fishermen in our region to develop a compliance monitoring EM program in the federal fisheries. While SB 209 does not create or propose a specific EM program, it does allow for a future program which could have significant implications for stakeholders and the state. And as somebody who's actively advancing EM in Alaska, I'd like to provide some context on the use of EM and some considerations. So to start, NOAA Fisheries and the industry have spent millions of dollars over the last decade developing two major EM programs in Alaska, one for Ketchikan County and one for compliance monitoring. These programs have had very specific objectives, required years of research via exempted fishing permits to develop functional and cost-effective programs. And I'm unaware whether whether there is a comparable process for research that exists within the department. And both of these programs were advocated for and developed by fishermen, and participation is 100% voluntary. They were developed within established monitoring frameworks at the federal level and have been used in conjunction with or supplementary to observer coverage and were integrated into the existing observer fee. The state currently does not have this level of infrastructure, and it's worth considering what types of resources and funding the state has to develop a new monitoring program where none currently exists. EM has potential long-term cost benefits. It also has significant upfront costs, which can vary wildly depending on a large suite of factors. Just for context, based on recent council analysis from our program, EM can cost upwards of $17,000 for equipment and then about $5,500 for annual ongoing costs per vessel. So just kind of think about that if you scale that up to a fishery the size of like Bristol Bay or Southeast or AM. So that doesn't include the cost for development of the monitoring program itself, any of the hiring and training of data reviewers to which you would need many, outreach and things like that that make a program successful. It's also worth considering what these same funds could accomplish if allocated instead to programs that the state already uses, such as expanding Alaska Wildlife Trooper presence. There are also some kind of outstanding constitutional concerns regarding privacy rights, data confidentiality, and sharing that the federal programs have avoided by using voluntary participation and outlining some pretty explicit data use limitations. And it's just worth considering how these will factor into a Board of Fisheries mandated program. My major concern with this particular bill, as previously stated, is that it is unclear if the intent of the amended language in the bill would be to authorize EM only in conjunction with an observer program, or if the intent is to allow authorization of the of an EM program independent of an observer program or as an alternative, which it kind of seems to be the case. And if so, it's unclear whether that EM program would be subject to the same written determination prior to implementation and those same criteria. So I can't stress enough that EM programs are very complicated. They are resource intensive and just as burdensome as observer programs and should be given the same rigorous setting prior to considering a new program. And I am happy to answer any questions or provide more context. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Levy. Are there questions from members of the committee? Okay. Is there anyone else in the room who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 209?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McCune. I'll represent myself as a small boat owner in this situation. I'm a gillnetter out of Prince William Sound, and a lot of these fishers are very small, and as UFA pointed out, we're kind of in a glut of salmon right now. $17,000 was, I didn't even make that last year. I mean, prices have plummeted so far, and your insurance is $4,000. Fuel was $5 a gallon. You know, just endless kind of things that put you out of business. But I think we're talking about a lot of fisheries. And if you didn't, somebody could put this proposal into the Board of Fish for any fishery in the whole state, whether it's just a tiny one, and say, we need to monitor those guys. And I mean, how would you run some of these cameras on some of these boats that are so small? And so anyway, that's my opinion is, I understand that, you know, the Board of Fish needs tools to be able to do things, but on the same token, I would not want to see this bill misused on some very small fisheries that are struggling right now to get along. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McCune. Questions? And we'll go back to Karen Severson in Petersburg. Ms. Severson, can you hear us? Are you available? Not available. Rats. One final call for public testimony today on Senate Bill 209. Question from Ms. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe after you close public testimony, before we are done today, would it be possible to hear from the commissioner again for a question that sort of came up during public testimony?
Sure. We'll hold public testimony open, but invite the commissioner to the table again for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, we've heard some public testimony here. Mr. McCune, for example, just now spoke about the very small boats and gill netters, that kind of thing. I'm not familiar enough with Area M. What size boats are we typically talking about there? And when the department was putting this together, was there any discussion about maybe limiting this to a certain size boat, you know, a certain length of boat? And I understand that practically speaking, it would go to the Board of Fish, but was there any thought of maybe even before that stage limiting this statute in that way?
Yeah, through the chair, no, we had no discussions about that. The primary boats that are out in the Area M fishery are two classes of boats. One, a gillnetter boat, which is a relatively small vessel that would be hard to put an observer on, much less even have electronic monitoring in some of those skiff-type boats. And the other ones are the same boats, which are, I think you're familiar with, they're about maybe 60 or 70 feet long, but, you know, have a full deck already around them. So, again, those are considerations the board would have. Is it feasible to put an observer on board a gillnet vessel like Mr. McCune's? I think they would have that discussion and incorporate that into their decision processes. The federal government also runs an observer program on for marine mammal interactions, and they can put observers on. They're discussing one right now, putting observers potentially on gillnet boats in southeast Alaska to deal with harbor porpoises. So I think many gillnet operators would at least prefer to have the opportunity to look at electronic monitoring as a feasibility rather than have a person, you know, being placed on their boat to look at harbor porpoise interactions in gillnet fisheries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Additional questions? Seeing and hearing no one else wishing to testify or ask questions at this time, we'll set the bill aside for further consideration. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Monday, February 12th. We will not be meeting on Friday, February 9th. As there is no further business before Senate Labor and Commerce today, hearing no objection, this meeting is adjourned at 2:23 p.m.